Rarely, but sometimes. I thought about my old coworkers back in Nowhere, where our training consisted of learning how to switch on the coffee pot, watching me sweat and run and parrot back this manual, unable to see 5 feet in front of me. They watched me spend every clocked-in moment blind and terrified, and then we laughed about it. The corner of South 2nd and Roebling was crowded with Puerto Rican families in their lawn chairs with adjacent coolers. They played dominoes. Kids screamed through the stream from a detonated hydrant. I watched them and thought back to that coffee shop on Bedford from the first day. I could probably walk in there now. I would say, "Yeah, I've worked on a Marzocco." "Oh, you don't know it?" But it wouldn't be enough. Whatever it was, just being a back waiter, a server, a barista, at this restaurant, I wasn't just anything. And I wouldn't call it being a 51%er because that sounded like a robot. But I felt marked. I felt noticed, not just by my coworkers who scorned me, but by the city. And every time a complaint, a moan, or an eye roll rose to the surface, I smiled instead. 3. And one day I ran up the stairs into the locker room, and a woman from the office followed me. She carried three hangers hung with stiff, striped Brooks Brothers button-downs. They were the androgynous kind of shirt that straddles the line between the boardroom and a circus. "Congratulations," she said in monotone, like her clothes. "These are your stripes." I put them in my locker and stared at them. I wasn't training anymore. I had a job at the most popular restaurant in New York City. I fingered the shirts, and it happened. The escape was complete. I put on navy stripes. I thought I felt a breeze. It was as if I were coming out of anesthesia. I saw, I recognized, a person. She stopped me on my first steps into the dining room, holding a glass of wine in her hand. I had the fleeting impression that she had been waiting for me a long time. "Open your mouth," Simone said, her head raised, imperious. Both of us looked at each other. She painted her lips before each service with an unyielding shade of red. She had dark blonde hair, untamable, frizzy, wisped out from her face like a 70s rock goddess. But her face was strict, classical. She held the glass of wine out to me and waited. I threw it back like a tequila shot, an accident, a habit. "Open your mouth now," she commanded me. "The air has to interact with the wine. They flower together." I opened my mouth, but I had already swallowed. "Tasting is a farce," she said with her eyes closed, nose deep in the bowl of the glass. "The only way to get to know a wine is to take a few hours with it. Let it change, and then let it change you. That's the only way to learn anything. You have to live with it." I had the next day off and wanted to celebrate. I took myself to the Met. The servers were always talking about the shows they saw: music, film, theater, art. I didn't know a single thing they mentioned, though I had taken an intro to art history course in college. I went because I needed something to contribute during napkin time. I don't know how long I had been in the city, but when I got off the train at 86th Street, I realized how narrowly I had been living. My days were contained to five square blocks in Union Square, the L train, and five square blocks in Williamsburg. When I saw the trees in Central Park, I laughed out loud. The lobby of the Met, that holy labyrinth, appropriately took my breath away. I imagined being interviewed 10 years from now, not like with Howard when I was tested, but interviewed with admiration. My amicable interviewer would ask me about my origins. I would tell him that for so long I thought I would be nothing, that my loneliness had been so total that I wasn't able to project into the future, and that this changed when I got to the city and my present expanded, and my future skipped out in front of me. I stuck to the Impressionist galleries. They were paintings I had seen 100 times reproduced in books. They were the rooms that people dozed in. Your body could go into a kind of coma from the dreamscapes, but if the mind was alert, the paintings galvanized. They were almost confrontational. And that confirmed what I had always suspected, I told my interviewer, that my life before the city had only been a reproduction. After I ran out of rooms, I started again. Cézanne, Monet, Manet, Pissarro, Degas, Van Gogh. This is what I want, I said, showing my interviewer the painting of Van Gogh's cypresses. Do you see how, up close, it's blurry and passionate, and from a distance, whole? And what about love? My interviewer asked me, unprompted, as I stared at Cézanne's apples. For a second, I saw Simone's red lips asking the question. Love? I looked around the gallery for the answer. I had wandered out of Impressionism into early symbolism. Where a moment earlier, I could have sworn the room was crowded, it was now nearly empty, except for an elderly man who stood with a cane and a younger woman holding his arm in support. When I was driving to the city, I had said to myself, I'm not one of those girls who moves to New York to fall in love. Now, in front of a jury of symbolists, Simone and the old man, my denial felt thin. I don't know anything about it yet, I said. I moved next to the man and his friend. His huge ears looked like they were carved of wax, and I was sure he was deaf. He was too at peace. We looked at Klimt's Woman in White, Portrait of Serena Lederer, the title said. She certainly wasn't one of his most daring, and stood in contrast to his later gold-leafed erotic works. But though she looked like a virginal column, she had in her face a restrained joy. I remembered something about an affair between the artist and the model, rumors that her daughter was actually Klimt's. She stood above the three of us, unconcerned with being stared at. The old man smiled at me before he walked off. "Show me," I said to the woman in white. We regarded each other and waited. I got off the train and the streets were glowing. I went to the wine stall in the mini mall on North 5th in Bedford. The man behind the counter had long hair and tired, hanging eyes. He turned down the biggie he'd been blasting when I came in. I looked at every single bottle, but I didn't recognize anything. Finally, after 10 minutes, I asked, "Do you have an affordable Chardonnay?" He had paint all over him and a cigarette behind his ear. "What kind of Chardonnay do you like?" I swallowed. "France?" He nodded. "Yeah, that's the only kind, right? None of that Cali shit. How's this? I have one cold." I paid him and held the bag to my chest. I ran home, crossing to the opposite side of Grand Street so I wouldn't be contaminated by the demons lounging outside of Clem's. I ran up my 4 flights of stairs too, ran into the apartment, stole Jesse's wine key and a mug, and ran up the last flight, pushing out onto the roof. The sky was like the paintings. No, the paintings were trying to represent this sunset. The sky was aflame and throwing sparks. The orange clouds rimmed with purple like ash. The windows in each high-rise in Manhattan were lit up like the buildings were burning down. I was out of breath, overtired from the museum. My heart drummed. A voice said, "You have to live with it." Another voice said, "You made it, you made it," and at the same time, in a blistering chorus, I said, "Made it where? Live with what?" I walked in on them in the locker room. Simone had been speaking loudly, sitting in a spare chair in her stripes with her legs crossed. He was standing in front of his locker, buttoning his shirt. They both looked at me, startled. "Sorry, do you want me to come back?" "Of course not," she said. But neither of them said anything else. The silence was accusatory. He dropped his pants, stepped out of them, and turned back to Simone. "Ignore him," she said. It sounded like an order, so I obeyed. I looked away. "Pick up," was the call. "Picking up," was the echo. 6 and 6, table 45, share," Chef said. His eyes didn't leave the board of tickets in front of him. "Pick up." I put my hands in front of me and grabbed. Another sweltering day. Air conditioners all around the city were giving up. As I pushed into the tepid dining room, I noticed the ice was melting in the oyster tray in my hands. Pale blue bodies amid sloshing ice chips. It looked disgusting. And 6 and 6 meant nothing to me. I had forgotten to check the day's oysters. I forgot the table I was going to. Simone flooded by me, and I reached for her. "Excuse me, Simone? Sorry, but which or which oyster? Do you know?" "Do you remember when you tasted them?" She didn't look at the plate. I hadn't tasted them when they had been passed around at family meal. I hadn't looked at the menu notes. "Do you remember tasting them?" she asked again, slowly, like I was dumb. "East Coast oysters are brinier, more mineral. West Coasts are plumper, creamier, sweeter. They're even physically different. One has a flat cup, the other tends to be deeper." "Okay, so which are which on this plate?" I held the plate closer to her face, but she wouldn't look. "Those are covered in water. Take them back to Chef." I shook my head. "Absolutely not." "You're not going to serve those. Take them back to Chef." I shook my head again, but sucked in my lips. I saw it all unfolding ahead of me. His anger at me, his yelling about the waste, my embarrassment. But I could look at the menu notes while I waited for the new ones. I could hear the table number again. I could figure it out. "Okay. Next time, look at them, but use your tongue." The managers maintained power by shifting things. They came into a server station and moved their dupe pad, moved their checks, rearranged the tickets on the bar. They pulled white wines out of the ice bucket, wiped them down, and reinserted them in a new pattern. They would pause you when you were running, obviously in a hurry, and ask you how you thought you were settling in. Simone maintained power by centrifugal force. When she moved, the restaurant was pulled as if by a tailwind. She led the servers by her ability to shift their focus. Her own focus was a spotlight. Service unfolded in her parentheses. "What's that bartender's name again? The one who only talks to Simone?" I asked Sasha. I was casual about it. Sasha was a back waiter. He was otherworldly beautiful. Broad alien cheekbones, blue eyes, bee-stung, haughty lips. He could have been a model, except he was barely 5'4". His gaze was so cold. You knew he had been everyone. A rich man, a poor man, in love, abandoned, a murderer, and close to death. None of these states impressed him much. Viet bartender, Jake. He was Russian, and though he was clearly fluent in English, he didn't bother to adhere to its rules. His accent was both elegant and comical. He rolled his eyes at me while he cut bread.
Okay, Pollyanna, let me tell you a few truths. You're too new.
What does that mean?
What you think it means. Jackie will eat you for dinner and spit you out. You even know what I'm speaking of?
You're not bouncing around after that.
I shrugged like I didn't care and filled the bread baskets.
Besides, he's mine. I'll cut your fucking throat if you touch him, and I'm not a joker.
Silence in the kitchen. Pick up.
Picking up. The kitchen was a riot of misshapen, ugly tomatoes. They smelled like the green insides of plants, like sap, like dirt. There were tomatoes of every color, yellow, green, orange, red-purple, mottled, striped, dotted. They were bursting. Seaming is what Chef called it, when the curves and indentations pulled apart from each other, but not completely, like parted lips. Heirloom season, Ariel sang out. She was also a back waiter. She always had pounds of eyeliner on, even if it was the morning. She had bangs and dark brown hair that she twisted up onto her head and held with chopsticks. She was still named Mean Girl in my head because she wouldn't speak to me during training, only pointed and gave exasperated sighs. But today, she was passing out dripping bar mops to the line cooks from a bucket of ice water. They wrapped them around their heads like bandanas or slung them over the backs of their necks. That didn't seem like something a mean girl would do. In fact, I hadn't seen anyone do something that compassionate with their bar mop stash. I heard from my own head, our first tenet is to take care of each other. She handed me a bar mop. I put it on the back of my neck, and it felt like rising out of a soggy cloud into clean air. Pick up. Picking up, I said. I looked expectantly to the window, but there were no plates lined up. Instead, Scott, the young, tattooed sous chef, passed me a sliver of tomato. The insides were tie-dyed pink and red. A marvel striped from Blooming Hill Farm, he said, as if I had asked him a question. I cupped it while it dripped. He pinched up flakes of sea salt from a plastic tub and flicked it on the slice.
When they're like this, don't fuck with them. Just a little salt.
Wow, I said, and I meant it. I had never thought of a tomato as a fruit. The ones I had known were mostly white in the center and rock hard. But this was so luscious, so tart, I thought it victorious. So, some tomatoes tasted like water, and some tasted like summer lightning. What are heirlooms? I asked Simone as I ran to get behind her in line for family meal. She had two white plates in her hand, and I felt a shiver of expectation looking at that second plate. I noted how she made her own. A generous tongful of green salad and a cup of the vichyssoise. Exciting, isn't it? The season? They're rare or unique breeds of plants and animals. Once all our tomatoes were like that. Before preservatives and supermarkets and this commercial food production hell we're living in. Breeds evolved in places based on one evolutionary principle. They tasted better. The point is not longevity or flawlessness. All of our vegetables were biologically diverse. pungent with the nuances of their breed. They reflected their specific time and space, their terroir. On the second plate, she took the biggest pork chop on the bone, a scoop of the rice salad, and a wedge of gratin potatoes. She said, "Now everything tastes like nothing." They conjoined in my mind. It wasn't that they were always together. Theirs was an oblique connection, not always direct. If I saw one, my eyes started to move, looking for the other. Simone was easy to find. Ubiquitous, directing everyone, she seemed to have some sort of system where she divided her attention between the servers equally. But I had a harder time tracking him, his alliances, his rhythms. If they were in the restaurant together, they had one eye on each other, and I had one eye on them, trying to understand what I was seeing. It wasn't like they were the only fascinating people at the restaurant, but they were an island if the rest of us were the continent. Distant, inaccessible, picking up stray light. Pick up. My eyes snapped open, but I was the barista today. The kitchen was far away. Howard looked at me from the Micros terminal. He was waiting for me to make him a macchiato, but I was overthinking it. I threw the first two shots away. I'm hearing Chef scream, "Pick up," in my sleep, I said, swirling the warm milk. It was as glossy as new paint. Punishing myself, I guess. "Thanatos, the death drive," Howard said. He laid a napkin over his arm and inspected a bottle of wine on the service bar. "We fantasize about traumatizing events to maintain our equilibrium." "Lovely." He took the macchiato and smelled it before taking a sip. He regarded me. The other managers wore suits, but somehow everyone in the restaurant always knew that Howard was the man in charge, as if his suits were cut from a finer fabric. "It's compulsive, but we actually find the painful repetition pleasurable." He took another sip. "It doesn't sound pleasurable." "It's how we self-soothe. How we maintain the illusion that we are in control of our lives. For example, you repeat, pick up, in hopes that the outcome each time will be different." "And you are repeatedly embarrassed, are you not?" He waited for me to respond, but I wouldn't meet his eyes. "You are hoping to master the experience. The pain is what we know. It's our barometer of reality. We never trust pleasure." Every time Howard looked at me, I felt bare. A coffee ticket printed up, and I used it as an excuse to turn around. "Are you dreaming about work often?" he asked. It felt like he spoke it into my neck. "No." I slammed a portafilter to empty it, and I could feel him walk away. But I was. The dreams were tidal, consumptive, chaotic. Service played over in my head, but no one had faces. And I heard voices, layered on top of one another, a cacophony. Phrases would rise, then evanesce. "Behind you, pick up, to your right, to your left, picking up, candles, can you, now, toothpicks, pick up, bar mops, now, excuse me, picking up." In my dreams, these words were a code. I was blind, and the directives were all I had to pick my way through the blackness. The syllables quaked and separated. I woke up talking. I couldn't remember what I had been saying, only that I was driven to keep saying it. Terroir. I looked it up in the World Atlas of Wine in the manager's office. The definition was people talking around it without identifying it. It seemed a bit far-fetched. That food had character, composed of the soil, the climate, the time of year. that you could taste that character. But still, an idea mystical enough to be highly seductive.
Ignore him. That's what I did. When Jake came into family meal late and took a seat next to Simone, when he pulled up on his bike outside the front window, when he called harshly out for bar mops, I looked away. But I started to hear things. All of it unverifiable and improbable. Jake was a musician, a poet, a carpenter. He had lived in Berlin. He had lived in Silver Lake. He had lived in Chinatown. He was halfway through a PhD on Kierkegaard. They called his apartment the Opium Den. He was bisexual. He slept with everyone. He slept with no one. He was an ex-heroin addict. He was sober. He was always a little drunk. He and Simone were not a couple, though their magnetic, unconscious way of tracking each other seemed to indicate otherwise. I knew they were very old friends, and that she had gotten him the job. Some nights, a cherubic strawberry blonde that Sasha called Nessa Baby came and sat in front of Jake at the bar as service was winding down. He knew part of his job was to be looked at. He was a quiet bartender. There was a submissiveness to his beauty that was nearly feminine, a stillness that made one want to paint him. When he worked the bar, he submitted. Women and men of all ages left business cards and phone numbers with their tips. Guests gave him gifts for no reason. That kind of beauty. If he rolled up his shirt sleeves, you could see the edges of tattoos that spoke to another private body he kept. It was the sight of his arm resting on the beer tap that changed me. The beer was acting up. The kegs were probably too new, not cold enough. Just foam, no beer. Jake let the foam pour while he talked to a guest. The drain was full of foam. It ran over to his feet, a spreading white pool. His sleeve was rolled up, the tendons of his forearm tensed from shaking cocktails. I remembered that static shock when I touched him. I felt the shock in my mouth. His inappropriate forearm and the foam cascading, his manner too casual, too condescending. "That's a lot of beer to waste," I said. My voice surprised me, ringing out over my vow of silence. He looked at me. Perhaps it was raining that night, a stifling tropical storm. Perhaps someone struck a match and held it to my cheek. Perhaps someone cleaved my life into before and after. He looked at me. And then he laughed. From that moment on, he became unbearable to me. You will encounter a fifth taste. Umami. Uni, or sea urchin. Anchovies. Parmesan. Dry, aged beef with a casing of mold. It's glutamate. Nothing is a mystery anymore. They make MSG to mimic it. It's the taste of ripeness that's about to ferment. Initially, it serves as a warning. But after a familiarity develops, after you learn its name, that precipice of rot becomes the only flavor worth pursuing, the only line worth testing. 4. The sardines are insane tonight. It's true, Chef called him a faggot. HR is freaking out. Have you been to Sambar yet? No, the best Chinese is in Flushing. I'm playing a show Wednesday. Scott is on fire. I was obsessed with Chekhov. I'm obsessed with Campari right now. I need to get my cameras out again. I'm fairly well known in the experimental dance world. Table 43 is industry, per se. If one more bitch cuts me off to ask for Chardonnay, if one more person asks for steak sauce, what the fuck? Carson isn't again without the wife. That's twice this week. Sometimes I think, fuck the pooled house.
I'm not jealous. Technically, I texted first, but he responded.
You don't get it.
I'm on day 3. I feel great, high all the time.
Will you water 24?
Will you drop bread on 49?
Move.
Fuck off.
Fuck you.
It's like the Rude Olympics in here today.
Ugh, they're just French.
And after I took the LSAT, I was like, wait, I don't want to be a lawyer. I still paint sometimes.
I just need space and time and money.
It's so hard in New York.
Allergy on 61.
It's not really romantic.
I'd fuck the mom.
Does she come in drunk? It's just lemon, maple syrup, and cayenne. It's just Nikki's martinis. Never drink more than one.
I just need representation.
It's like banging against a brick wall. I need soup spoons on 27.
Chef wants to see you now.
I'm dropping soup now. What did I do?
Fuck, the mid-course.
Pick up.
The tickets came from a printer on Chef's right. They flew into the air like an exclamation and fluttered down in a wave. He yelled,
fire Gruyere, fire Tartare, hold calamari, hold 2 smokers.
From that code, the cooks on the line went into action. Chef lined up the tickets, bouncing from foot to foot like a child who had to go to the bathroom. He was a small man from New Jersey, but classically trained in France. He screamed anecdotes at the cooks, recalling real kitchens, where chefs would slam you in the head with a copper pan if you couldn't chop the parsley fine enough. Chef's voice was too loud, and he couldn't really control it. The servers and managers were always complaining that you could hear him from the dining room. Everyone, even Scott, his number 2, kept their eyes averted if he was on a tirade. The man paced the kitchen red-faced, primed for explosion. The line cooks were a blur of movement while essentially staying in one place. Everything was within arm's reach in their stations. Sweat funneled off their eyelashes. There were open flames or salamanders at their backs and heat lamps in the pass at their front. They wiped the rim of each plate before passing it to Chef, who inspected it mercilessly, eager to find smudges of stray sauce or olive oil.
Pick up.
Picking up. I was the food runner. I was next. I covered my hands with bar mops. The plates heated up like irons. I expected them to glow.
I heard you don't know the oysters yet, said Will, startling me.
Will was Sergeant, the guy who had been in charge of me on my first day. Even though I had my stripes now, he still seemed to think I was his project. Jesus, I said. Everything is a lesson around here. It's just dinner.
You don't get to say that yet.
Pick up.
Picking up, I responded.
Pick up.
Louder, said Will, nudging me forward.
Picking up, I said, harder, hands outstretched, ready. It was all one motion. The roasted half-duck had been in the window for going on 5 minutes while it waited for the risotto. The plate baking. At first, as with all burns, I felt nothing. I reacted in anticipation. When the plate shattered and the duck thudded clumsily onto the mats, I cried out, pulling my hand to my chest, caving. Chef looked at me. He had never really seen me before.
Are you kidding me?
He asked, quiet. All the line cooks, butchers, prep guys, pastry girls watched me. I burned myself. I held out my palm, already streaked with red, as proof.
Are you fucking kidding me?
Louder, a rumbling, then quiet. Even the tickets stopped printing.
Where do you come from? What kind of bullshit TGI Fridays waitresses are they bringing in now? You think that's a burn? Do you want me to call your mommy?
The plates are too hot, I said, And then I couldn't take it back. I stared at his feet, at the mess on the floor. I bent over to pick up the beautifully burnished duck. I thought he might hit me. I flinched, but held it out to him by its leg.
Are you retarded? Get out of my kitchen. Don't even think about setting foot in here again. This is a church.
He slammed his hands on the stainless steel in front of him.
A fucking church!
His eyes went back to the board and he said, quiet again.
Refire, duck, refire, risotto on the fly. What the fuck are you looking at, Travis? Keep your eyes on your steak before you turn it into cardboard.
I set the duck on the counter next to the bread. The grating noise of tickets printing, of plates being thrown around, of pans hitting burners, it all throbbed with my hand. In the locker room, I went to the sink and ran lukewarm water on it. The mark was already starting to disappear. I cried and continued crying while I changed out of my uniform. I sat on a chair and tried to calm down before I went back downstairs. Will opened the door.
I know, I yelled. I fucked up, I know.
Let me see your hand. He crouched next to me. I opened my palm and he put a bar mop filled with ice cubes into it. I started crying again.
You're okay, doll.
He patted my shoulder.
Put your stripes on. You can work the dining room.
I nodded. I put on fresh mascara and went downstairs. The mess was 7 two-tops on a balcony over the back dining room. The stairs were narrow, steep, treacherous. A lawsuit waiting to happen, they told me. I took them one at a time, up and down, and still soup spilled onto rims, sauces slid. Heather was debutante smile, and she got in trouble weekly for chewing gum on the floor. She was from Georgia, with a delicate southern accent. They told me she had the highest tip average, and everyone blamed the accent. I thought it might be the gum.
Sweetness, she snapped her gum at me. Start the stairs with your left foot when you go down. Lean back.
I nodded.
I heard about Chef. It happens.
I nodded again.
You know, nobody's from here. We were all new. And like I always say, it's just dinner.
From a section of the handbook I neglected to read, workers were to receive one complimentary shift drink after they clocked out. Workers were also to receive one complimentary shift coffee per 8-hour shift. When this translated off the page, quantities increased. Entitlement ran rampant. But I didn't know that yet. They wound us up. They wound us down.
Take a seat, new girl.
Nikki was definitely talking to me. I had just clocked out and changed. I was cracking my wrists and heading toward the exit. It was still a touch early. Cooks were plastic wrapping the kitchen, servers swiping the final credit cards and waiting in the hutches. The dishwashers piled trash bags at the exit of the kitchen. I saw them peeking out, trembling like sprinters, waiting for the signal that they could take the bags to the curb and go home. Where? At the bar. He wiped down a spot. Nikki was Clark Kent glasses. He was the first bartender they hired, and they said he'd be there until they shuttered the place. His glasses were often crooked and at odds with the crookedness of his bow tie. He met his wife at the bar 10 years earlier, and she still came in and sat in the very same seat on Fridays. I heard he had 3 kids, but I couldn't really comprehend it. He seemed half-child himself. He had an unpretentiousness and a Long Island accent that had been drawing people to the bar for decades.
You want me to sit like a regular person?
Like a regular old person. What do you want to drink? I wanted to ask how much a beer cost. I had no idea.
It's your shift drink. A little thank you from the owner at the end of the night.
He shook the amber, watery remains from a cocktail shaker into his glass.
Or a big thank you. What do you like?
White wine sounds all right. I climbed onto a stool.
Earlier in the night, mid-rush, Nikki had asked me if I had any common sense. I thought about it all night. I had no idea what to say to him, especially now that I was stripeless. Except, yes, I think I do have common sense.
Yeah, nothing particular?
I'm easy.
That's what I like to hear from my back waiters.
I blushed.
Boxla? He asked and poured me a taste. I lifted it to my nose and nodded. I was too nervous to actually smell it. He poured me a glass, and I watched as he left his hand there, the wine surging past the pour line we use for guests. The glass now seemed a goblet.
You did better tonight, said a voice behind me. Will jumped up onto the bar stool next to me.
Thank you. I sipped my wine before I could undo the compliment. The Albert Boxler Riesling, not from Germany, but from Alsace, one of the high-end pours at $26 a glass. And I was drinking it. Nikki had served it to me. To thank me. I rolled it through my mouth the way Simone had taught me, pursing my lips and cupping my tongue and almost making an inward whistle. I thought it would be sweet. I thought I'd tasted honey, or something like peaches. But then it was so dry it felt like someone had pierced me. My mouth watered, and I sipped again.
It's not sweet, I said out loud to Nikki and Will. They laughed.
This is nice, I said. An hour ago, these were incredibly privileged seats, occupied by the kind of people who spent $30 on an ounce of Calvados. Will had changed his tone with me since my burn. He was careful, or perhaps protective. I thought maybe he wanted to be my friend. He wouldn't make a terrible first friend. He wore a khaki shirt, reminiscent of safaris. He had a long arrowhead nose and bovine brown eyes. He spoke rapidly, nearly slurring. Those first trails, I thought it was because he was in a hurry. Now I saw that he didn't want to show his teeth. They were square and yellowed, and the front left one was cracked. He pulled out a cigarette.
Are we all clear?
Yes, sir. Nikki slid him a bread and butter plate. I panicked when Will lit up. I barely had memories of a time when you could smoke inside restaurants. He asked if I wanted one. I shook my head. I glued my eyes to the back bar, pretending to be absorbed in the memorization of the cognac bottles. The two of them traded incomprehensible insults about two baseball teams from the same place.
You say hi to Johnny tonight.
Nikki polished glasses from a never-ending pile on the bar. They were stationed like soldiers that progressed to the front only to be replaced by more in the back.
He was here, I missed him.
He was next to Sid and Lisa.
Christ, those two. I stayed as far away as possible. Remember that Venice is an island argument?
I thought he was going to hit her that night.
If I was married to that, I'd do worse than hit her.
I kept an impassive face. They must be talking about their friends.
What are you drinking, Billy Bob?
Can I get a hit of Fernet while I think about it?
This is it, said Ariel, slamming the glass racks down on the corner of the bar. The glasses jangled like bells, and her hair flew up.
You've got your hair down already?
Nikki asked. His voice was harsh, but his eyes playful.
Come on, Nick, please. I'm done. You know I'm done. Don't I look done?
She ran her fingers through her long hair, scratching at the scalp like she was trying to undo a wig. She flipped her hair to one side and leaned over the bar, feet coming off the ground. "Come on, Nick, snip, snip." She made a scissors motion with her fingers. Ariel looked like trouble with her hair down. She had gone from quirky to something from the underworld. Her hair welled past her breasts, kinky from being knotted up all night. Her bangs were flat on her forehead, and slashes of liquid eyeliner that once had swung rebelliously away from her lids were now smudged and battered. During services, Ariel worked with the energy of a bird, through a series of chirps, clicking noises, phrases half-sung. She became frantic easily and recovered just as easily, whistling.
"Okay, you're cut, Ari. But I do need 2 bottles of Rittenhouse and 1 bottle of Fernet."
"Okay, I'll bring the rye, but homeboy here can get his own Fernet." She eyed Will's glass, which had a black liquor in it, reeking of oversteeped tea and bubble gum.
"You drink it, you stock it."
"Fuck off, Ari."
Will exhaled smoke toward her.
"Fuck you, darling."
She flounced away. Will shot back his drink.
"What's that?"
I asked.
"Medicine," he burped. "It's for the end of a meal. Incredible curative properties for the digestive tract."
He reached over the bar and started to fill a water glass with beer. Nikki stopped working and watched.
"I just fucking cleaned that, Will. If you spill 1 fucking drop..."
The beer shook in Will's hand, and the head rose an inch out of the glass. A hush. It kept rising, but didn't spill.
"I'm a pro," Will said.
"Misery," said Ariel.
She put 2 bottles of rye on the bar and pulled out the stool on the other side of Will. She was in a black slip. Or maybe she thought it was a dress. Her bra was neon yellow like a traffic sign saying, "Proceed with caution."
What is open?
She tucked her legs under her and reached into the speed rack behind the bar.
"Can you animals get off my bar? I'm trying to clean."
"Is that Shiganda still good? When did we open it?"
2 nights.
"Pushing it.
Worth considering."
Nikki put up a glass and a black bottle with an insignia at the top and went back to his cleaning.
"Self-service tonight? You poured for the new girl?"
"Ariel, I'm not fucking around. You barely stalked. She doesn't even know her head from her asshole yet, and I think she could have done a better job. You put me back 20 minutes.
"It looks like you picked the wrong night to be bartender, old man."
Ariel emptied the wine into her glass, smelled it, and flipped open her cell phone. "If Nikki had spoken to me like that, I would be flattened." But nothing happened. There wasn't even residual tension. Nikki yelled, "All clear," into the kitchen, and the porter sprang from behind the closed doors. They ran bags down the line behind the bar, an endless caravan of black bags to the curb. They propped the door open, and the hot, dark air rushed in, as sticky as fingers running over my face. Misery. I drank my Riesling. Medicine.
"It's been really hot," I said.
Nobody responded.
"Summer,"
I said. Droning came in from the streets, then a rustling. For a second, I thought it was the claustrophobic noise of the cicadas from my childhood, or the wind bending branches, or the moans of cows in fields. But it was cars. I wasn't used to it yet. The elimination of nature. The brimming wine of overheated machinery. I shifted a little toward Will, wanting to seem open in case anyone talked to me. Will and Ariel were on their phones, and Nikki was cursing to himself behind the bar. I thought about taking my phone out. It was new. I had left my old one on my dresser back home. I wondered what my father had done with it, with the boxes of books. Though I was also fairly certain he hadn't opened the door to my room. When I got my new phone, the area code felt like a badge. 917. I dutifully copied everyone's contact information into it. But I didn't have missed calls or messages. No one even asked me to cover shifts yet. I don't have an air conditioner, I said.
Really?
Will shut his phone and turned to me.
Seriously?
They're expensive. Misery, Ariel interjected. She leaned around Will and looked at me inquisitively. What do you do? Oh, I have big windows and a fan. When it's really bad, like that stretch last week, I take cold showers to get the sweat.
No, she said. Her eyes said, you fucking idiot.
What do you do in the city? Are you trying to be something?
Yes, I said.
I'm trying to be a back waiter.
She laughed. I made Ariel laugh.
Yeah, after that, the sky's the limit.
What do you do?
I do everything. I sing, I write music, I have a band. Willie here is trying to make a film. A claymation version of A Bout du Souffle.
Okay, that was one idea. It's not the worst idea.
No, it's very admirable. A week of sculpting clay to get the right look of boredom.
Ariel, I can't be offended that you don't understand anything about art. I blame first, your gender. Second, the system.
Honestly, though, Will, tell us the truth. You're just masturbating, right? In that little dark room with your clay Jean Seberg.
Will sighed. I will admit it's hard not to.
He turned to me.
I actually am working on something else. I'm writing a feature.
The comic book one? The hero's journey? The exploration and reaffirmation of the patriarchal narrative?
Ariel, do you ever shut the fuck up?
She smiled and rested a hand on his shoulder. She picked up her glass of wine and was about to sip when she said, oops, and turned to us.
Cheers, she said gravely.
Cheers.
No, in the eyes, new girl. Look her in the eyes, Will said, or she'll put a hex on your family.
I looked in her blackened eyes and said cheers like it was an incantation. Our three glasses touched, and I pulled a mouthful of wine. The joints in my spine softened, like butter going to room temperature. Then three things happened, seemingly at once. First, the music changed. Lou Reed came over the speakers like a mumbling, beloved poet uncle. You know, I saw him once at the Gramercy Park Hotel. Have you seen what they fucking did over there? That, my friends, is a rotten omen if ever there was one. So anyway, I'm sitting there, and it's like Lou fucking Reed, and I'm thinking, thank you for teaching me how to be human, you know? I tried to keep listening. I nodded when Ariel looked at me, but the song was as intimate as a faucet dripping in the night. Next, the bar stools filled. The cooks, the closing servers, the dishwashers, all out of their uniforms now, commandeered them. Everyone looked sloppy and criminal without their stripes. To see the scarred hands of the cooks against rumpled polos or old heavy metal t-shirts, you wondered what it would be like to see one of them on a subway, without knowing they had a secret, authoritative life in whites. Simone walked down the line, her hair untied. I tried to catch her eye, but she went to the far end of the bar with Heather, and who I now understood to be Heather's boyfriend, Parker, the man who'd initiated me on the coffee machine. Simone didn't look like a statue of herself anymore. She wore plain leather sandals, and she swung one off her foot when she crossed her legs. And finally, Chef banged out of the kitchen with a baseball cap and a backpack on. All his rage had melted away, leaving a man who looked like a dad on his way to a minivan. Everyone said, "Good night, Chef," in a forceful sing-song. He waved without looking. He barreled through and exited the building. A curtain came down as Nikki reappeared behind the bar in a white undershirt and turned the lights up. The restaurant where I worked turned into a social club after hours. The bartenders weren't performing bartender anymore. They were mixing drinks with playful proportions. The cooks weren't looking over their shoulders for chef or walking numbly into hot panhandles. They were rolling joints, giggling, punching each other. The servers were stretching their arms and shoulders, comparing knots in their necks, stirring drinks with a finger, while complaining in one long, loving torrent about Howard, Zoe, dissecting the guests with a tone of passive contempt. I started to be able to tell when they were talking about regulars, because they would all want to outdo each other, demonstrating that they were the favorite. Too dazzled to contribute, I watched them. It was the duality of everyone that floored me. Simone with her simple softness, her tired eyes. Will and Ariel snipping at each other. The talking got louder as the drinks receded. I kept looking at the open door, thinking a stranger would walk in and want a drink, or that the owner would decide to pass down 16th Street on his way home from an event and catch us and call the police. "I'm new. I'm blameless," I would say with hands up. No one else seemed concerned. It made me wonder who really owned the restaurant. "Black Bear?" Scott yelled down the bar to Ariel. "No, Park Bar. Sasha just texted. He has a corner."
"No mas Park Bar," he said. Jared and Jeff, two of his line cooks, started laughing.
"No, you did not fuck the new one. Vivian?"
"Vivian!" they shouted. They raised their glasses.
"Full of shit," Ariel yelled. She turned to me and said, "Fuck, I thought she was gay."
"Too slow, Ari," said Will.
"Oh, we'll see about that." She put her hand on top of mine and said into my eyes, "They always start off straight. That's part of the fun." I laughed, petrified.
"What time is it?" I asked.
A wall of exhaustion hit me with the drinks. It seemed to be a good moment to excuse myself. I didn't know who was going to clean this all up, so the restaurant would be blank and sterile for the morning. When I looked down the line, I saw Simone. She was texting, and I thought, it's too late for her to be texting. That was when I first realized she was older. An image of him hit me in the back of my throat just from habit. Who did Jake turn into when they turned the lights up? The shift drink. The first liminal space between work and my apartment. A space that I could project onto for hours. A space of inevitability where I would catch up with him eventually.
"It isn't two yet," Ariel said, as if something switched at two.
"Do you do this every night?"
"Do what?"
I nodded toward my glass of Boxler that refilled itself every time my eyes were averted, to the half-empty wine bottles that lined the bar for consumption, to Nikki eating cocktail olives while he and Scott told each other to fuck their mothers, to Lou's gravelly serenade coasting down on us through a film of smoke, to the row of us, unkempt, glassy and damp, sweating drinks in our hands.
"This?"
Ariel waved away the smoke in front of my face, waved it away like it was nothing.
"We're just having our shift drink."
5.